A new mass movement to bring the troops home is moving across the U.S. faster than the power failure of last Thursday. Veterans from as far away as Boston, Baltimore, and Pittsburgh will meet in New York City tomorrow at a rally sponsored by Bring Them Home Now, a coalition of veterans and their families. While over 140,000 U.S. troops are in harm's way in Iraq, one soldier is fighting a different battle here at home. Army Sergeant Vanessa Turner fell victim to a mysterious illness in May 2003 and was pronounced in danger of imminent death. She was flown to a military hospital in Germany and was retired by the military. Her family was called to join her, but was advised that the Army had no responsibility to fly them to Germany since Turner was no longer on active duty. Through the aid of Senators Edward Kennedy and John Kerry of Massachusetts and the USO, funds were deducted from Turner's ATM card to pay for her family to fly to Germany. Turner spent 2 months recuperating at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C., but for her, the war continues, this time the battle to receive medical care. Peace Watch spoke to Turner last week about her battle with the Veterans Administration. Since that conversation, we've learned that the American Legion, a veterans association, has advised Turner that the Army had no cause to retire her in Germany and that her daughter would not receive greater benefits in the event of her death, even if she were still on active duty. Today, we continue our conversation with Turner regarding conditions in Iraq and her reaction to being retired.
It's like I said in numerous papers, it's easier to be a soldier than it is to be a veteran. Because at least with a soldier, you're guaranteed to go to war. You're guaranteed to get 3 meals a day, ma'am. You're guaranteed to get shelter, guaranteed to get all this stuff. But when I come home and you don't know being a veteran, it's hard because you're going from one place. If they can't help you or if they won't tell you, they shove you to another door. I'm like, come on now, what's going on? And it's very frustrating. I get aggravated, but I never gave up, and I still won't give up. But it's just aggravating. I'm just pushed to the side, numerous doors. I'm just keep being pushed. And it's hard for me to adapt, you know. Mm. I don't know. It's hard.
There are reports that the Congress is considering cutting the combat pay of the soldiers in Iraq.
Really? Wow. We're in arm's way. I mean, when I was there, you could see bullets flying in the air. At nighttime, they got what they call tracers. And the place that I was actually stationed on was an old Iraqi air base. So every night, we can see our boys, 4th Infantry or 3rd Infantry, shooting back at the Iraqi soldiers outside the gate. And you can see all these illuminated tracers all through the air. I mean, war has not ended. War has not ended. You know, it's horrible. And they want to cut combat pay. We're in the trenches. Iraq is the most dirtiest country I've ever seen. And I've been to a few countries. Iraq is horrible. No clean running water. No electricity. Saddam Hussein's face is on everything, ma'am. On the side of billboards, on the side of buildings, milk cartons, on money. His face is everywhere. Big old statues, murals. He doesn't monopolize the whole country.
How did the people respond to the presence of the U.S. troops, in your experience?
Well, some are okay, obviously, because there are some good Iraqis that were on our base. But you still can't really trust them 100% because you never know. But their views were they couldn't stand that guy, and he done caused strife in their life during their whole time growing up. And then some, when you're riding down a 26-hour convoy on both sides, left and right of you, you see Iraqis, even little babies smaller than one or two, giving us the finger as we driving by in our convoys, taking their index finger and going across their neck as to say, America, you're going to die. Little kids, ma'am, no older than 2 and 3, doing that, sticking up fingers, throwing stuff at us. I mean, that was horrible. Mm-hmm. That was horrible. And our serial commander said, when we go through these little towns, do not stop your vehicle. And the whole time in my mind, because I'm a driver, so the whole time in my mind, ma'am, I'm going through these little towns, and the Iraqis have decoys as far as the women and children, and I'm saying to myself, please don't let any of these people jump in front of my 5-ton, because I'm going to have to run them down. It's either me or them. And I'm thinking, please do not step in front of my truck, because if they do, my instructions were, do not stop your vehicle, continue to roll, because it's ambush time. So my mind was on high adrenaline. I'm like, oh, my God. It was very scary going through those towns. Very scary.
Your orders were if a woman or a child stepped to the vehicle or in front of the vehicle?
In front of the vehicle, because they were like decoys or suicide bombers. And
how do you know that?
Because the commanders, you know, they get word from different other commanders. He would tell us, he would brief us. Before we were going on convoy, he would brief the whole unit once we got into our trucks. He would say things like, they put children and women as decoys, watch out for that. They have either white cabs or white trucks that are filled with explosives. They're saying, if you see in your rearview mirror any white trucks on the left or the right side of you, haul butt, because those are also suicide bombers.
Did you or anyone there witness women and children being used as decoys or suicide bombers?
No, thank God we never had to encounter that as far as to really actually hit somebody. But this one instance when we were going on our route to Baghdad. Now, we have four serials, mind you, and each serial has about 50 cars in it, 50 trucks, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was in the first serial, and we went down a wrong road or whatever. The first 8 cars did get shot at. We didn't know that then, but once we got to our destination and was safe and sound, we had another big meeting, and our commanders told us this. Our first 8 cars did get shot at because we went down a wrong side road or whatever. So I didn't know what was going on because I'm further back. It was horrible. It was horrible. And I drive a 510 truck. And I don't know if you ever seen one, ma'am, those big trucks, Army trucks?
No, not really.
You haven't seen one? And my particular truck that I'm driving has a Class 3 leak, which means that truck should never left Germany. But they took it anyway because they needed more vehicles. So every 20 to 40 minutes, we would have to stop the convoy. All the other soldiers would have to get out their vehicles to stand to, and I, me personally, would have to put oil inside my truck, or else it wouldn't have made it. It was beyond a Class 3 leak. And that was horrible. And I told the mechanics, I told my sergeants, I told anybody who was anybody then in Germany, this truck has no business being in Iraq. You put me and my passenger in harm's way. Oh, your truck's going to make it. Your truck's going to make it. It's not going to overheat. If it does overheat, my instructions was to, first, my one instruction was to wait until help came. You think I'm going to sit in that truck and wait for help to come while I'm a sitting duck? You're crazy. Then another commander said, no, whatever car's in front of you or whatever car's behind, your particular car, if it stops, you jump in it. And that's just what I was going to do. I wasn't going to wait inside this truck and be a sitting duck. They're crazy. But that's what I was told. I would have to sit there and wait until rescue team came to get me, because that truck was a viable asset, whatever. I said, the truck is busted up.
Were you surprised that the Iraqis weren't greeting you all with flowers and kisses and hugs? Is that what you were told by the military when you went in?
I thought, I knew that they wasn't going to greet us like that. I knew it was a hostile time. I knew we were in arm's way, because when we're driving in convoys, we can't really see them. They can see us. And if you go down Sniper Alley, ma'am, they're smart, because during Sniper Alley, they knock down all the telephone poles, all the lights. So going down there at night, you're going to get ambushed. You're going to get ambushed. So our serial commander tried to, every time we set out to go from destination to destination, it was early in the morning, so we'd be traveling during the daytime, opposed to traveling at night. Oh, they're smart. I know they weren't going to be like that. They're very smart people.
So were you still there when President Bush made the statement to bring them on?
Yes. And we were all sitting around the TV, and we were like, hey, you know, they said all kinds of rude comments, but some of us were saying, won't you come over here and put on a gas mask and come over here with your M16 and sit and see what we do and see how it feels. You tell them to bring them on, you're sitting over there. Oh, yeah, we were upset. We were cussing at the TV. Mm-hmm. Yes, we were.
Sergeant Vanessa Turner,
yes, ma'am.
Any final thoughts on your part?
Basically, I don't want people to think that I'm negative about the military. I love my military. I love what I do. I love being a soldier. The only thing that I think that made me upset coming back from all this is that admissions as far as paperwork wasn't done properly. My stays in hospitals wasn't done properly, I think, and now the care now is not done properly. But I love my military. I love being a soldier. So don't think I'm bashing the government or the military, because I'm not. I'm just talking about one incident helping me after I came back from what I've been through.
So would you sign up and do it all over again?
Yes, I would. Yes, I would.
Mm-hmm. Army Sergeant Vanessa Turner, who contracted a mysterious illness while on active duty 70 miles from Baghdad, Iraq. Turner has been battling the U.S. military to receive medical treatment since she returned to the U.S. in May 2003. Presently, investigation is underway by the American Legion as to whether the military acted illegally in medically retiring Sergeant Turner while she was in danger of imminent death. Peace Watch will keep you abreast of developments in her case as they occur. The situations of both Iraqis and American soldiers fighting on the front lines was also of concern to members of the group Veterans for Peace that held its national conference in San Francisco recently. Among the presenters was someone who's not a veteran but has written a lot about the subject. William Rivers Pitt is the managing editor of the website truthout.org and author of the New York Times bestseller War on Iraq. He offered these thoughts.
If the American people fully knew what this war in Iraq was really about, if they fully knew what it means today to be a soldier in that part of the world, they would tear the White House apart brick by brick. If the people had but a taste of the horror and the lies, they would repudiate this administration and all that it stands for. They don't know because they have been fed a glutton's diet of misinformation and fraud, and changing that is why we are here. The 1st of August saw a very interesting article published in the Washington Post. The title was, U.S. Shifts Rhetoric on Its Goals in Iraq. The story quotes an unnamed administration source, and I will bet you all the money in my wallet that this source was a man named Richard Pearl, who outlined the newest reasons for our war over there. That goal is to see the spread of our values, said the aide, and to understand that our values and our security are inextricably linked. Our values. That's an interesting concept coming from a member of this administration. We make much of the greatness and high moral standing of the United States of America, and there is much to be proud of. The advertising, however, has lately failed to completely to live up to the product. Is it part of our value system to remain on a permanent war footing since World War II, shunting money desperately needed for human services and education into a military machine whose very size and expense demands the fighting of wars to justify its existence? Is it part of our value system to lie to the American people, to lie deeply and broadly and with no shame at all about why we fight in Iraq? Is it part of our value system to sacrifice nearly 300 American soldiers on the altar of those lies? To sacrifice thousands and thousands and thousands of innocent civilians on the altar of those lies? Is it part of our value system to use the horror of September 11th to terrify the American people into an unnecessary war?
No!
Into the ruination of their civil rights? Into the annihilation of the Constitution? Is it part of our value system to use that terrible day purposefully against those American people who felt most personally the awful blow of that attack?
No.
Is striking first part of our value system?
No.
Is living in fear part of our value system?
No.
It is not part of my value system. It never will be. This new justification for our war in Iraq is yet another lie, an accent in a symphony of lies. The values this administration represents play no part in the common morality of the American people, play no part in the legal and constitutional system we adore and defend. One of the worst things ever to happen in this country was to allow the people within this administration to use the words freedom, justice, democracy, patriotism, for those good and noble words become the foulest of lies when passing their lips. For the record, the justification for war on Iraq was the procurement by Iraq of uranium from Niger to use in a nuclear weapons program, plus 26,000 liters of anthrax, 38,000 liters of botulinum toxin, 500 tons of sarin, mustard, and VX nerve agents. 500 tons, for those of you without your calculators, is 1,000,000 pounds. Almost 30,000 munitions capable of delivering chemical agents, several mobile biological weapons labs, and connections between the Iraq regime and al-Qaeda that led directly to the attacks of September 11th. Well, we sold it to them. So. None of these weapons have been found. The mobile weapons labs, termed Winnebagos of Death by Colin Powell, he said that in public, turned out to be weather balloon platforms sold to Iraq by the British in the 1980s. The infamous Al-Qaeda-Iraq connection has been shot to pieces by the recently released September 11th report and by common sense for anybody who knows and understands the way the culture works over there. And the Niger uranium claim was based upon forgeries so laughable that America stands embarrassed and ashamed before the judgment of the world. This is all featured on the White House's website on a page called Disarming Saddam Hussein. The Niger claims specifically have yet to be removed. Lies. Lies.
Lies.
All lies. The Washington Post story, however, reveals a deeper truth here. Now that the original and terrifying claims to justify this war have been proven to be utterly and completely phony, Niger recently asked for an apology, by the way. The administration is falling back upon the justification for war that these men have been formulating for years and years and years. They call it Pax Americana, a plan to invade Iraq, take it over, create a permanent military presence there, and use the oil revenues to fund further wars against virtually every nation in that region. This we call bringing our values over there. Norman Podhoretz, one of the ideological fathers of this group of neoconservatives who now control the foreign policy of this nation, described the process as the reformation and modernization of Islam. That's a pretty fancy phrase. I'm a Catholic. I can call it by what it really means. Crusade. We know all about those. This is the project for the new American century. The product of a right-wing think tank that, in 1997, was considered so far out there that no one ever thought its members would come within 10 miles of setting American policy. One broken election, however, vaulted these men into positions of unspeakable power. Their white papers, their dreams of empire at the point of the sword, have become our national nightmare and the nightmare of the world. I speak of Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Pearl, John Bolton, Louis Libby, and the rest of these new American century men who have taken our beloved country and all it stands for and thrown it down into the mud. You will note that I did not name George W. Bush. Blaming George W. Bush for the gross misadministration of this government is like blaming Mickey Mouse when Disney screws up. He is not in charge. Truman said the buck stops here, and so we point to Bush as a symbol of all that has gone wrong. But he is not in charge. These new American century men, have delivered us to this wretched estate. And by God in heaven, there will be a reckoning. But is it all ideology for these men? Of course not. There is the payout. Have you ever heard of a company called United Defense out of Arlington, Virginia? Let me introduce you. United Defense provides combat vehicle systems, fire support, combat support vehicles, weapons delivery systems, amphibious assault vehicles, and combat support services. Some of United Defense's current projects include the Bradley family of fighting vehicles, the M113 family of fighting vehicles, the M88A2 recovery vehicle, the Grizzly, the M9 Ace, the composite armored vehicle, the M6 linebacker, the M4 command and control vehicle, the battle command vehicle, the Paladin, the future scout and cavalry system, the Crusader, electric gun technology and pulse power technology, advanced simulations and training systems, and fleet management. The list goes on and includes virtually everything an eternal war might need. Who owns United Defense? The Carlyle Group, who bought United Defense in October of 1997. For those not in the know, the Carlyle Group is a private global investment firm. Carlyle is the 11th largest defense contractor in the U.S. because of its ownership of companies making tanks, aircraft wings, and other equipment. Carlyle has ownership stakes in 164 companies, which generated $16 billion in revenue in the year 2000 alone. The Carlyle Group, surprise, surprise, does not provide investment or other services to the general public. Who works for the Carlyle Group? George Herbert Walker Bush works for the Carlyle Group, has been a senior consultant for Carlyle, and sits on the board of directors. This company is profiting wildly from this war in Iraq, a tidy gift from son to father. And then, of course, there is Dick Cheney's Halliburton, profiting in the millions and soon to be the billions from the oil in Iraq. Halliburton's subsidiary, Brown & Root, is also in Iraq. Their stock and trade is the building of permanent military bases. Here is your permanent military presence in Iraq, and all for an incredible fee. Cheney still jaws a $1 million annual check from Halliburton, what they call a deferred retirement benefit. In Boston, we call that a paycheck. Pax Americana. That which President Kennedy spoke so eloquently and specifically against when he said, "What kind of a peace do we seek?" Not a Pax Americana enforced upon the world by our weapons of war. That is now the rule of law in this nation. It must be stopped, and we must be the ones to stop it. This is America. At bottom, America is a dream, an idea. You can take away all our roads, our crops, our people, our cities, our armies. You can take all of that away, and the idea will still be there, as pure and great as anything conceived by the human mind. I do very much believe that the idea that is America stands as the last best hope for this world. When used properly, properly, it can work wonders. That idea, that dream, is in mortal peril. You can still have all our roads, our crops, our people, our cities, our armies. You can have all of that. But if you murder the idea that is America, you have murdered America itself in a way that 10,000 September 11s could never do. The men and women within this current administration are murdering the idea that is America with their Patriot Acts, their destruction of civil liberties, their lies, their daily undermining of even the most basic tenets of decency and freedom that we have tried to live up to for the last 227 years. That and that alone should be enough to get you on your feet with your fist in the air, whether or not you believe you have any chance of stopping this. We may not win, but we damn well have to fight them. If we don't, we are the traitors that they would have us, that they would say we are. When you stare into the obsidian darkness of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., it stares back at you. The stone of the monument is jet black, but polished so that you must face your own reflected eyes if you should dare to read the names there. You are not alone in that place. You stand shoulder to shoulder with the dead. And when those names shine out around and above and below the person that you see reflected there, you become their graveyard. Your responsibility to those names, simply, is to remember. Remember what that dream, that idea that is America, is supposed to be. Never forget it. Never let your children forget it. Hand it down, generation after generation, because it is the most valuable heirloom that we possess. If we lose it, we lose everything. When all else fails, I fall back on the words of the extraordinary anti-war activist Daniel Berrigan. A friend of Berrigan's, Mitchell Snyder, was for years an advocate and an activist for the homeless in Washington, D.C. Snyder became despondent over the fact that his government could spend billions on bombs and planes and guns, but couldn't seem to find the money to help the homeless. Snyder became so despondent that he committed suicide. Daniel Berrigan penned these lines in memory of Snyder, and it is in these lines that I find my hope and strength when the darkness creeps too close. Some stood up once and sat down. Some walked a mile and walked away. Some stood up twice and sat down. "I've had it," they said. Some walked 2 miles and walked away. "It's too much," they cried. Some stood and stood and stood. They were taken for fools. They were taken for being taken in. Some walked and walked and walked. They walked the earth. They walked the waters. They walked the air. "Why do you stand?" they were asked. "And why do you walk?" "Because of the children," they said. "And because of the heart. And because of the bread. Because the cause is the heart's beat. And the children born. And the risen bread. The cause is the heart's beat. It is yours. The cause is my heart's beat. May it be there for all time until that day comes when we can once again stand in awe and pride before our flag and our government and our nation, when we can once again revel in the rescued dream that is America. Until then, we are at the barricades and on the streets and in the faces of all of those who would spend the precious blood of our men and women on lies and profit and greed. The obsidian darkness of that memorial demands it of us. The golden ideals of this nation demand it of us. The laws of our forefathers demand it of us. More important than anything, we demand it of ourselves. They can take nothing from us that we are not willing to give, and we are not willing to give this great nation up. Let them be warned. We stand our ground.
William Rivers Pitts, recently in San Francisco at the National Conference of Veterans for Peace. Thanks to Sarah Olson for production assistance with that segment. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. And our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, TruthOut.org, and Steve Albertson at WebActive.com for web help. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible. So we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at Pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.